Want to, I would encourage you to open your Bibles up to 2 Kings chapter 5, as that's where we'll spend at least the first half of our study together this morning, talking about what happens here with the healing of Naaman. But I need to give us just a little bit of the historical background and context for the events that we're going to look at this morning, so that we'll hopefully be able to have a better appreciation for what actually happens in the account that we're going to look at. Aram, or Syria, depending on what translation of the Bible you are reading out of, was Israel's neighbor to the north. And throughout their history as two separate nations, they were kind of in this on-again, off-again conflict with one another. In fact, the conflict between these two nations goes all the way back into the days of David, when he conquered the king of Zobah and kind of subjugated the Arameans and made them and incorporated them as part of his kingdom. But after the death of David's son Solomon, under Rehoboam, David's grandson, the kingdom of Israel split into two. You had the northern kingdom of Israel, which was the 10 tribes in the north, and then you had Judah and Benjamin in the south. They were the southern kingdom. And it seems that somewhere around this time, when Israel was in a weakened state, the Arameans again rebelled against the authority of the kings of Israel. And there was always these kind of ensuing conflicts that was happening between them. These conflicts certainly intensified greatly in the days of Ahab. In fact, much of Ahab's story concerns his many wars with the Arameans in the north. In fact, it was in a conflict with the Arameans that Ahab lost his life in battle, where that archer drew his bow almost at random, it seems, and let loose and found the chink in his armor and struck him, and he died there in his chariot. You could read about that in 1 Kings chapter 22. Now, after the death of Ahab, though, there seems to have been a little bit of a time of relative peace. At least we're not told much about their conflict with the neighbors to the north, because when Ahab's son Ahaziah comes to the throne, the Moabites in the south rebel against the king of Israel. Apparently, they had been subjugated by Omri, Ahaziah's grandfather, and now that they're seeing this change in leadership in Israel, they use it as an opportunity to try to throw the yoke of Israel off of their shoulders, and they begin to refuse to pay the customary tribute to Ahaziah. And Ahaziah was a very weak king, and he did not do very much well. In fact, what little is told about him is that he was a bad king and he led the people of Israel into more idolatry. Fortunately for Israel, he only reigned for less than 2 years. And he died without an heir to the throne. And so his brother, Joram, or Jehoram, depending on what translation you're reading out of, another son of Ahab, came to the throne and began to reign over the nation of Israel. And in the early years of Joram's reign, he spends much of his time and attention down there in the area of Moab, putting to rest this rebellion of the Moabites. And so it would appear, at least from the narrative, that during the early days of Joram's reign, while he's occupied with his rivals in the south, he is enjoying a relative peace, or at least there's no active conflict between Israel and their neighbors to the north, the Arameans. Nevertheless, I would suggest to you that they were still adversaries with one another, and they would again fight against each other many times. In fact, they would fight against each other even later in the reign of Joram. The king of Aram would come down and besiege Samaria to such an extent that they are eating their own children. So, at best, I would suggest to you that right now, at this time in history, in the narrative of what we're going to talk about, the events we're going to talk about today, there was at best a brief period of tense and strained ceasefire. The peace was tenuous and very fragile right now. And yet we're going to see some interaction between these two nations, the kingdom of Aram and the kingdom of Israel. And so that brings us, though, then to the narrative that we want to look at today in 2 Kings chapter 5. And we're really going to look at the first 14 verses, beginning in verse 1. We're introduced to the main character, at least one of the main characters in this section, a guy by the name of Naaman. We read, "Now Naaman, captain of the army of the king of Aram, was a great man with his master and highly respected, because by him the Lord had given victory to Aram." So he's the captain of the army of the king of Aram. The king of Aram at this time would have been Ben-Hadad II. He is a high-ranking official, and he is well thought of by his master, the king. And we're told here that it was by him that the Lord had given victory to Aram. And probably that is in reference to the prior victories that the Arameans enjoyed over the Israelites during the final days of Ahab. In fact, it's interesting, Josephus, the Jewish historian, suggests that that random archer who let loose his arrow was none other than this nobleman, Naaman, captain of the armies of the Arameans. And he was indeed a valiant warrior, but he was a leper. And you might be thinking, that is terrible. How could he possibly be doing any of this stuff? I mean, we read in the Bible that lepers were outcasts and they were banished from society and they had to go around proclaiming themselves unclean, 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 and all this kind of stuff. In fact, if you read the books of the law, you would think that the leper, to be leprous, is the epitome of uncleanness. And indeed, it is a good image of that. But not every nation treated the lepers the way that the Israelites were instructed to treat the lepers. It does not appear to be the case with the Arameans that they banished those who had this disease. In fact, Naaman still seems to function within society here in Aram. He's leading the army, which means he's with his soldiers going into battle. He even appears to have access to the royal court because he's going to go into the presence of the king and talk to him here in a little bit. And so, I know we think of leprosy as this terrible, terrible thing, and it's just horrendous. It doesn't appear societally to have been as bad for the Arameans, though I want you to understand this. Physically, health-wise, it would have been just as detrimental to Naaman as it would have been to any Jew who had contracted this disease. But we meet in this narrative a young Israelite slave girl. We're told about her beginning in verse 2. "Now the Arameans had gone out in bands and had taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife." So she has been captured by these Aramean bands. And I don't know, that could be a reference to some of the conflicts when the armies of the Arameans invaded Israel and they would kind of conquer and pillage and then take back plunder with them. Or it could be that during this time of relative peace, you have some marauding bands of the Arameans, these kind of gangs that are going down in or crossing the border and pillaging villages and capturing people and stealing stuff, taking advantage of the tumultuous situation along the borders of these two rival nations. But at any rate, this young Israelite girl finds herself ripped away from her home and placed into the service of Naaman's wife. And probably she was a house slave, tending to the daily needs of the lady of the house, which means she would have been present and around, and she probably overheard conversations and saw interactions between Naaman and his wife, her master, and she becomes aware of this predicament that Naaman is in, that he is a leper. And I would suggest to you that she had some amount of sympathy or care or compassion for her master and for his wife. We read in verse 3 that she said to her mistress, "I wish that my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria. Then he would cure him of his leprosy." This young girl obviously had heard about this prophet of God, and she is no doubt talking about Elisha, who was the main prophet who was working in Israel at this time. And she knows that this guy is powerful, that God is with him, and that he can do some amazing things. And she says, "Man, I feel so bad for my master's situation." And again, remember, this is coming from a Jewish perspective. Leprosy was terrible. Leprosy made you an outcast, right? So I wish that he could just go to Israel, to Samaria, and see the prophet of God who's there, because then he could be cured of his leprosy. And this message is somehow related to Naaman, probably by his wife, who then goes to the king to tell his king, Ben-Hadad, about this possibility that he can be cured from this debilitating disease. We read in verse 4, Naaman went in and told his master, saying, "Thus and thus spoke the girl who is from the land of Israel." And the king of Aram, this is the real interesting part, this interaction between Ben-Hadad and Joram, the king of Israel. Notice that Ben-Hadad says, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." And so he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver and 6,000 shekels of gold and 10 changes of clothes. So he's going to send Naaman into the enemy's territory to the king of the enemy. And he's going to say, "Listen, I'm going to send you with this gift, and I'm going to send you with a letter with some instruction, some communication to Joram, the king down there." And we find out the contents of the letter in verse 6. "He brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, 'And now as this letter comes to you, behold, I have sent Naaman, my servant, to you, that you may cure him of his leprosy.'" Ben-Hadad sends a letter to Joram and says, "I'm sending you my servant. I know we're enemies, but I'm sending you my servant, and I want you to cure him." That seems like a little bit of a weird ask. It's really not an ask, though. It's more of a command, is the way it sounds. Perhaps Ben-Hadad thought, "I am in a position of power over Joram, and so I can tell him what to do." And what's interesting is that Joram interprets this letter in exactly that way. He freaks out about it. Verse 7. "When the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, 'Am I God to kill and to make alive that this man is sending word to me to cure a man of his leprosy?' I can't do that. I don't have the power to do that kind of a thing. God's the one who has the power to do that, not me. I'm nobody when it comes to healing diseases." He thinks that Ben-Hadad is really just trying to pick a fight with him. "But consider now and see how he is seeking a quarrel against me. I know what you're really up to, Ben-Hadad. You're trying to just pick a fight with me because you're asking me to do something that I can't do. And when I can't do it, you'll get mad at me and then have a reason to come in and attack me." What's interesting is with this making of demands from Ben-Hadad and then the assuming of the worst by Joram here, one thing that both of these guys seem to have forgotten is they seem to have forgotten all about God. Ben-Hadad makes a request of Joram that should have been a request made to God, and Joram, in his response, forgets to go to God with the problem. Instead, he just thinks the worst. War is going to be coming. But God intervenes, and he sends Elisha, his prophet, this man of God, to step in. And Elisha sends word to the king. He heard in verse 8 that the king of Israel had torn his clothes. And so he sent word to the king saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Now let him come to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." Elisha says, "Joram, settle down. Don't panic. I've got this. Really, God's got this. Send him to me and we'll take care of this issue for you." And so then there's this interaction between Elisha and Naaman. So we read in verse 9, "Naaman came with his horses and his chariots and stood at the doorway of the house of Elisha." He comes with all this pomp and circumstance with his chariots and all of this great gift that's been sent along with him. And he rolls up to the door of Elisha's house. What's interesting is that Elisha does not fulfill Naaman's expectations. Naaman is expecting something big to happen, something momentous, something spectacular to happen. But this is what happens. Elisha doesn't even come outside. Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times and your flesh will be restored to you and you will be clean." Here, Naaman is rolled up all the way from Aram to the doorstep of Elisha, and he's thinking, "Come on, man, just come on out here, heal me, do something." And Elisha doesn't even bother to come outside and say hello. He sends his servant with a message and says, "You want to be healed, go to the Jordan River, dip 7 times, and you'll be healed." Now, Naaman is perturbed at this. Verse 11. Naaman was furious, and he went away and said, and notice his words, "Behold, I thought, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. I thought he was going to do this spectacular thing with me. I thought I was going to see, like, you know, the glowing stuff and the sparkles, and the air was going to move, and he was going to wave his hands over the place. He was going to say this cool prayer, and we would see the leprosy evaporate off of my body, you know? I thought it was going to be awesome. He wants me to go dip in this muddy river, the Jordan. Doesn't make any sense." He goes on, he says, "Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" I mean, if you're not going to do something miraculous, at least let me go bathe in some clean water, man. And he leaves, irritated, aggravated, disappointed, going away in a rage. But notice the wise counsel of his humble servants. "Then his servants came near and spoke to him and said, 'My father, had the prophet told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it?'" And trying to put myself in Naaman's mind, Naaman would be thinking, "Obviously I would have done a great thing. That's what I wanted." And they said, "Well, how much more then when he says to you, 'Do this simple thing, wash and be clean.'" I mean, Naaman, master, if you were ready to do this great thing, whatever great thing it was that he had called upon you to do, you would have done it without hesitation. If you were willing to do that, then doesn't it make sense that if he asked you to do just a simple thing, that you would just go ahead and do that without any reservation? And we read in verse 14, "So he went and dipped himself seven times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean." He saw the rationale. He saw the logic. He saw the wisdom in their counsel. Yeah, I mean, I guess that makes sense. If I was ready to do this great thing, then I ought to be willing to do this simple thing that was asked of me. Let's make some application of this to ourselves. And I hope that maybe today I can be the voice of the humble servant here, who helps us to see the wisdom in doing the small thing. I wonder sometimes if we're willing to answer the call of God when his call is mundane, boring, and little in our eyes. I think far too often we want the big experience. We imagine and we desire the miraculous to happen in our lives, the stupendous, the momentous things to occur in our lives. Maybe we wanted that in our conversion. You know, we read in the New Testament about the apostles and how they saw the risen Jesus and how their interaction with him transformed their lives, and they became cowards who are hiding and scared for their life to these bold proclaimers of the resurrection, even willing to go to their death to preach it. We read about the conversion of Saul of Tarsus in Acts chapter 9, and how he was this vehement enemy of God's people, of the Christians, and then on the road to Damascus he was confronted by Jesus in the bright light. He's blinded. And then a man is sent to him, and he is baptized, and he's washed clean, and the blindness, the scales fall from his eyes. And we're like, man, I want my conversion to be something awesome like that, right? In fact, you hear people talk about, I've talked to a lot of people over the years that have told me that they are saved, and I ask them, well, how were you saved? And they'll say something like, well, you know, I was baptized as a child, and then when I was at summer camp, you know, I had this experience. And it was as if the clouds parted and the light came down on me, and I felt warm and fuzzy, and I could just feel the Spirit of God coming upon me, and I knew, man, I knew that I was saved. I'll be honest, I'm a little jealous of that. I want that kind of experience. The people that tell you that God will speak to them, and they can audibly hear His voice giving them instructions and directions. You know, I think sometimes we want that in our spiritual walk and our spiritual growth. I mean, who wants to pore over the Bible all the time and study it, dissect it, and meditate on it? Wouldn't it be nicer if God would just sit on our shoulder and whisper in our ear and tell us what we're supposed to do? We want that! We want those kinds of miraculous experiences in our lives. And maybe we're even a little bit disappointed when we don't feel or see God working in our lives and transforming us. You know, we want that. Sometimes we're under this impression that my life is a wreck. I've got all these problems. I've got all these struggles and all these temptations. And my relationships are falling apart. And I've got problems at work and all this kind of stuff. But I know what I'll do. I'll just submit my life to the Lord. I'll be baptized into His name. And I'll rise to walk in newness of life. And I'll be a new creature. And that means everything will be better. And yet we wake up the next morning and we still have to go to work. And we still have to interact with the same people. And we still face the same struggles and the same temptations. The thing that tempted me before I was a Christian still tempts me the day after I became a Christian. And we think, well, what happened? I thought there was supposed to be this big transformation going on in my life. We want to hear God speaking to us, directing us. And when we don't hear anything, we don't feel His miraculous presence with us, we don't see that immediate, drastic transformation of our lives, we begin to think, well, I'm a little bit let down. Sometimes we want the big in our mission and our purpose in life. We want to be something big. We want to do something big for God. Right? We want to serve Him in a big way. Boy, I wish God would call me to be an evangelist or a preacher or a missionary overseas. I mean, if God called me, if He placed that on my heart and He called me to be an overseas missionary, man, that is a call I would respond to. I would sell my stuff and I would pack my bags and I would fly overseas and I would preach the gospel to those poor lost people over there in Africa or in China or in South America or wherever it is. I would do that for Him. Maybe we think, I want to do something big here. I want to host a revival here. I want to preach to the multitudes. Maybe I want to be some sort of theologian or author who writes and publishes all sorts of books that people can now have and read as resources to help them grow and understand God better. I want to do all those things for the glory of God. Maybe we want to be just more important in our sphere of things. Or we want to have a position of power within society so that we can have a platform now through which we can reach the masses and change the world around us for Christ. Right? And so we have people who are endeavoring to get into social media, to be influencers and build up a following there so that they can share the gospel and shine their light. We think, man, if God called me to be a social media influencer for Him, man, that is right up my alley. I would do that. Maybe it's that we see politics is so messed up. I need to get involved in politics. I need to run for local office and then state office and then federal office, because then if I can get in a position of power with my Christian principles, I can bring about mass change for our nation. And we would gladly serve in the Senate or Congress as a Christian if that's what God called us to do. Or maybe I'm going to build up my business. I'm going to become a big CEO. Then I can use my business to bless all those around me. That's God called me to do that, man. Those are the kinds of calls that we would be excited about. Sometimes we just think in terms of making a big sacrifice for God. We want to make that sacrifice that is going to make a lasting and impactful difference in the world around us. We want to be the ones who take that principled stand for the truth. The one that gets kind of the media attention and we become kind of the lightning rod around which discussion is being had over topics like abortion or homosexuality Or maybe like back during the pandemic when the government said, you're not allowed to assemble. We said, no, we're going to still assemble. We're still going to get together because you don't have a right to tell us to forsake God's instructions. And there certainly were some pretty well-known pastors and Christians during the time of the pandemic in much bigger towns than ours who became the beacon in their state for, we're not going to listen to the government in this because it's wrong. That's what I want to do. I want to make that kind of a sacrifice. Lord, I would be willing to lay down my life for you. You want to throw me in jail for my beliefs? Go ahead, throw me in jail. I'll do that for you, God. I'm willing to be persecuted. I want to be persecuted for the sake of the gospel. Because those things seem big. Those things seem important. Those things seem valuable and worthy. That's who I want to be. But let me ask you a question. And I'm not saying that those things that I've just listed, that they are invalid ways of serving God, or that they're unimportant, or that they're unworthy of us aspiring towards. But let me ask you this question. What if God hasn't called you to do something big? What if God hasn't called you to the miraculous or the amazing or the big things like this? What if God has just called us to be mundane, ordinary people of His? What if God just called you to be a wife or a husband? What if He's called you to be a father or a mother, a brother or a sister, a son or a daughter, a friend, a neighbor, maybe a boss, maybe an employee or a coworker, maybe to work in graphic design, maybe to be an electrician or to work at the steel mill, maybe to be a home caretaker. Maybe He's called you to be a retiree, a teacher, a teller at the bank. If that's all that God's called you to do, will you still submit to Him and serve Him in that capacity? Will you allow Him to lead you in that role and to guide you in that purpose and to show you how you can be the best version of that thing that He has called you to be for His glory? Will you shine your light wherever you're at, even if it's not glamorous or noteworthy or spectacular? Or will you get upset like Naaman? I thought God was going to do something special with me. I thought it was going to be big. That's all He wants me to do? I'm afraid that we underestimate the value and the importance of serving God where we're at. Now, Paul has this discussion in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 17 through 24. We're not going to read that, but I'll just sum it up like this. There was some questions among the Corinthians about whether or not now that they had been saved, was that supposed to, by default, change their relationships or their status in life? And Paul will make the argument there in those verses. He says, were you called as a slave? Were you converted to God while being a slave? He says, don't worry about it. You don't have to become free, a free man, in order to serve God. If you can, then go ahead and do it. But you don't have to. You can still serve God as a slave. In the greater context there, he's saying, are you married to an unbeliever? That's fine. You can stay married to them. Because you can still serve God as a spouse, even to one who's not on board with your faith. The point is God has called us where we're at, and He expects us to serve Him where we're at. And I'm afraid sometimes we don't think that that's important enough. We think there's nothing special about that, or valuable, or impactful about being just a plain, ordinary, in my case, husband, and father, or son, or a worker, or a servant. There's nothing special about that. Certainly God wants more from me. But you know what's interesting as I survey the Word of God and the history of his people is that throughout history, God has used people of simple, obedient faith to achieve his purposes. In reality, the vast majority of disciples of the Lord throughout the ages weren't special. We don't know their names. We don't know what their occupations were. They were just ordinary folks like you and me, living mundane, average lives. But though they were ordinary and mundane, they were men and women who lived every day and every aspect of their lives in all their various relationships under the guidance and authority of God. And through their ordinary lives of serving him day in and day out in their various relationships, they showed to the world around them the reality of a living God. And not just that God exists, but that God wants a relationship with us, with his creation. That he cares about us, and that he loves us. When we start to think that the mundane is unimportant, we could not be more wrong. All I am is a wife. Peter says, 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, that even if you have an unbelieving husband, let him be won to the word without speaking a word as he observes your chaste and respectful behavior. You mean, wives, you can lead your husbands to the Lord just by being a godly wife? That's exactly what Peter's saying. Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 12 to be careful about his conduct. Notice this one with me. I don't want to misquote it. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, and in verse 12, he says, let no one look down on your youthfulness. Did you hear that, young people? You could just be a young person. But rather in your speech, in your conduct, in your love, in your faith, in your purity, just by being a normal, good, godly young person, show yourself an example of those who believe. Well, I'm just a lowly worker bee at the plant, at the factory. I don't have much impact. Paul told Titus in Titus chapter 2, verse 9, urge bond slaves to be subject to their own masters in everything, to be well-pleasing, not argumentative, not pilfering, but showing all good faith. Be a good worker. I mean, yeah, I'm blown away sometimes when I get out in the work world and I realize how poorly people work. It blows my mind. I can't fathom that attitude and the mentality that's behind a lot of it. But if you will just do these things, which I just always thought were common sense, but this is what God is saying to do. Do what your boss tells you to do. Try to do a good job. Don't be argumentative. Don't be trying to cause problems. Don't steal, whether that's taking money or time. Showing good faith in all things. That's the definition of being, in my mind, a good worker. But notice what it does. It will adorn the doctrine of God, our Savior, in every respect. You realize that just being a good employee, a Christian employee, can speak volumes to the world about the gospel. That's why Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 31, whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. And Jesus, in his Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, talks about how we are the light of the world, the salt of the earth. Nobody lights a lamp and puts it under a bushel, a basket, like the song goes, right? No, you put it on the lampstand so that all can see. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. He says, therefore, let your good works be seen before men, that they will glorify God. It's sometimes been said that you will not be willing to die for the Lord if you are not first willing to live for him every day. And I would suggest to you that if we want the big test or even the big challenge or to make the big statement about our faith, we need to recognize that we'll only be able to do the big if we first do the mundane. So maybe you haven't been called to preach to the Colosseum, but you have been called to invite your neighbor and your friend to come hear the gospel. That's what Philip did with Nathanael. We found him. We found the Messiah. Can any good thing come from Nazareth? Come and see. He didn't have the answer. But he said, come on, let's go check it out. Maybe you haven't been called to be a martyr for your faith, but you've been called to present your body as a living sacrifice to the Lord, which is your spiritual or reasonable service of worship. Maybe you haven't been called to feed the hungry masses, but you have been called to show hospitality to one another without complaint. Maybe you haven't been called to be a famous author or theologian, to teach in the universities, but you have been called to teach your children, to bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Which, even though Ephesians 6 and verse 4 is directed towards fathers, understand mothers are not exempt in that. Timothy was taught from a young age the scriptures by his mother and his grandmother. Perhaps you will never be called to lead an army into battle, but you have been called to love your enemy and to pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. That's actually what that young servant girl did in our story. She was a captive in a foreign land, enslaved unjustly. She was serving her enemies. And she could have been spiteful. She could have been, well, I know about that man of God back home, but I'm not going to say nothing. She could have tried to leverage that, like we didn't read about it, but Gehazi, Elisha's servant, later on in that story, will try to leverage what Elisha has done, what God has done, to gain monetarily from Naaman. She could have used her knowledge to leverage for her freedom, but she didn't do that. Instead, she demonstrated the characteristic that Paul tells all of us we're supposed to have in Philippians chapter 2. To not look out for our own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. That we're to humbly serve those around us. The attitude that Christ had when he left heaven and humbled himself to come down and serve us. So will you answer God's call for you to serve him with your life? Even if it seems ordinary. Even if it seems boring. Even if it seems mundane. Recognizing that sometimes it's in doing the small things that the greatest good is accomplished by our God. Will you answer his call today?